You know, the scriptures are very clear about the importance of the text that we're looking at this evening. It's been building the suspense all the way through that chapter, and I've kind of done that by breaking the chapter up in smaller units and dragging it out a little bit to make you also anticipate it. He's been building this anticipation for the revelation that's about to be given. Nebuchadnezzar has been troubled by it. Remember, he had the dream, and it so disturbed him that he could not sleep anymore, and he called all the wise men to come in and tell him his dream and the interpretation thereof. And they says, we don't know what the dream is. How can we ever find out? He says, well, you need to find out what this dream is from your gods and through your mystical arts, and then tell me what the interpretation is. But they couldn't find out what this dream was. They had no idea what it is. And then he says, if you can't reveal it to me, then all of you are going to be under the death sentence. Your life is on the line unless somebody tells me the dream. And so the news went out, and they were arresting people to put them away and have them killed. Well, finally, they came to take Daniel and his friends. And Daniel says, well, wait a minute. My God can give us this dream. Let me pray about it, and he'll tell me the dream, and then he'll tell me the interpretation. And so they give him permission to go spend some time in prayer, and he learns the dream. But does he tell us the dream? No. He goes in this big praise of God, how great God is, that he knows the secrets, all the secrets, he's all-knowing. And God is all-powerful over all the kingdoms of the world. And God raises up kings and he brings them down. And our God is truly an awesome God, worthy of all respect and all glory. Because he reveals secrets to human beings. But we're still not told the dream. Then he goes in and he's finally given permission to come before Nebuchadnezzar. And does he tell him the dream right away? No, he once again tells how great his God is and how God reveals these mysteries. Finally, after all of that, he's ready to tell us the dream. And that's what we're going to look at today. Only now is the dream and interpretation made known. And it truly does reveal the wisdom and the power of our God. So turn to Daniel chapter 2, we're at verse 31. Daniel chapter 2, verse 31. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is a dream. Can you imagine everybody? They were thinking maybe a vague picture of what the dream was. He goes through detail by detail by detail of this dream, everything that happened. And you can just imagine Nebuchadnezzar, wow, you know it. Inside and out, you know the dream. You truly have understanding. Well, let's look at it. He saw a statue. This is not an idol, it's a statue. And it's very important to understand it's a statue of a man. So often, the kingdoms of the world are recognized by their founders. I couldn't help but think of the communism. When it took over in Europe, you have this huge statue of Lenin. You know, the people that brought in the power. And kingdoms of the earth are often tributes to a man who established them, who built them. You have King Nebuchadnezzar, you have Alexander the Great, you have Cyrus of the Medes and the Persians. You have men. And these are the kingdoms of man, human kingdoms. And he sees this giant, huge statue. We're not told exactly how big it is, except in the next chapter, he decides to make a statue right after this, most likely because of this dream, and he makes it 90 feet high. It's huge. And it's brilliant, because it's made up of all these shining metals. And you can just imagine the sun hitting that and just glowed. It was beautiful. Brilliant with its brightness. But it was also terrible. And the idea is frightening. It struck terror when he saw this, because what does this mean? What does this represent? This huge, foreboding statue. And then he goes through the parts of the statue. And he starts at the top and he works his way down. And as he goes down, each section is of decreasing value, but it's also of increasing hardness with each kingdom. The head is of fine gold. By the way, Nebuchadnezzar loved gold. He liked to accumulate all he could. The breast and arms are of silver. You got it on the midsection, the belly and thighs, is of brass or bronze. And then the legs are of iron, with the feet being of iron and brittle clay. It was a mixture of iron and then clay, a hard, tough iron, but clay like in pottery that's brittle. It can be broken. And they were mixed together, which they don't mix. It's just parts of one and part of the other. Well, that's what he sees. And then, as he's looking at the statue, there's this stone, not made by hands. In other words, it's not something that man came up with. We see how often in Scripture, in fact, in Hebrews this morning, you notice that there's a temple in heaven not made with hands. It means it's something that God has brought into existence. And in the Old Testament worship, you used altars not carved out of stone. You just took the stones and piled them up and made your altars, because there's the idea that God made those things. And God, when it's not made with hands, it means it's something God brought about. He brought it into existence. And so this is his kingdom. And it comes out of the mountain, and it smote the image at its feet, its weakest point, because as you went down, they kept becoming weaker, especially the feet. They're a mixture of this clay and brittle pottery. And it smashes those feet to pieces at its weakest point. But it broke the whole thing. It was the last part of it, but the whole thing collapses. The iron, the bronze, the silver, the gold, it just comes plumbing down. It's broken to pieces. It becomes dust, actually, that floats in the air, and it's blown away like chaff, blown away by the wind. So there's nothing, absolutely nothing left. Marks the end of the statue and all that it represents. And then the stone that has utterly destroyed the statue grows and grows. It becomes larger and larger, and it grows into a great mountain that filled the whole earth forever. There you have it. That's the dream. But what does it mean? What's the interpretation of the dream? When Daniel gave all this detail and gave the full report of this dream, everyone realized that he truly had gained this from God, because Nebuchadnezzar vouched that that is exactly what I dreamed. So now he must have the insight of what this dream means, because the same God who gave him the dream had to give him the meaning of what this dream is all about. And so this is the part that everybody was waiting to hear. Chapter 2, verse 36. And we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O King, art a King of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And whosoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the heaven, he hath given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. You're the head. I think Nebuchadnezzar kind of liked that. You're the King of Kings. You know, you have absolute power and authority and over everything. And he even uses creation language. You're over the beasts of the field and the flowers. You're over not just mankind, you're over everything. You have absolute power and authority. Except there's a little catch to it. It's because my God's given it to you. Yeah, you're all of that because God's allowed you to be that. He raises kings up and he brings them down. Because a true God has given to you power and strength and glory. You rule with absolute power over all things because God's allowed you to rule with absolute power. And you alone are that head of gold. Now it's kind of interesting that he does this with him because all the rest are kingdoms. But here he focuses right on the king himself, Nebuchadnezzar himself, because it's a face on the statue, and he implies that's you, Nebuchadnezzar. Because Nebuchadnezzar, unlike the other kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar truly was Babylon. He ruled with an absolute authority and a power. Whatever he said, that was it. He ruled for 43 years. The empire after him only lasted for another 23 years before it was destroyed. And in those 23 years, there were five kings. There was never anyone like him with the Babylonian Empire. He really was Babylon, the king of Babylon, the king of kings. And he ruled with absolute authority. And his great rule was due to the sovereign decision of the Almighty God. Chapter 2, verse 21 brings that out. And he changes times and seasons. He removed the kings and he set up kings. And you're one he set up. But what are the next part? He goes to the next verse, verse 39. And this is where the controversy begins. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. Now he just alludes to these next two kingdoms. He'll get into this a little bit more detail in chapter 7. But right now he just alludes to these two. And here's where the debates begin. At one time, pretty well all the critical scholars said that these two kingdoms, the first, second one was the Medes, and the third one was the Persians. And the reason they did this was then they could make the fourth kingdom the Greeks, with Alexander the Great and eventually the Antiochus Epiphanes. And the reason was, is they said Daniel was written around 165 BC. And it was written and used the story of Daniel and his friends and put the words in Daniel's mouth because everything had already occurred. And so they're writing about what's happened and crediting it to Daniel. And some, in recent days, I got two newer evangelical commentaries, and they bought into this. In fact, a lot of newer writers are, because they're saying, well, there's connection, there's so many similarities to some of the things of the Greeks that we think maybe this was during the time of Greece, and that it's leading up to this. And so we've kind of bought into what the liberal scholarship was teaching for years. And I'd like to defend the fact that I don't think that's what's going on. Some say, well, that makes sense because Greece became a divided kingdom, it talks about it, and it was all broken up. Well, here's the first problem. The Medes never existed as the distinct kingdom after the Neo-Babylon period, after the time of Nebuchadnezzar. When the Babylonian Empire finally collapsed, the Medes and Persians were already one kingdom. The Medes, as a kingdom, were before that. And so you can't, and there's a clear progression here. You have one kingdom, after that another kingdom, and after that another kingdom, and after that the fourth kingdom. And so the Medes, if it was the Medes, they had to be after the Babylonian kingdom, but they weren't. They were before that. They were already one entity at that time. Because Cyrus, who conquered Babylon, ruled a joint kingdom. Turn to Chronicles 36, 2 Chronicles 36. Verse 22. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of what? Persia. That the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, and he made a proclamation throughout all the kingdoms and put it in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath the Lord God of heaven given to me. And he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem. So Cyrus, who conquered the Babylonian Empire, and under whom they were allowed to return from the Babylonian exile, was recognized as the king of Persia, which consisted of the Medes and the Persians. It was a combined kingdom already at that time. So he conquered as the king of a united kingdom, the Medes and the Persians. Also, even in the book of Daniel, go to chapter 5, verse 28. Remember the handwriting on the wall? Sometimes I say, people won't believe something, even if it's written on the wall. Well, here it's written on the wall. Peres, thy kingdom, that's Persia, is divided and, or press, not divided, that's what the word means. Thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So he says to him, your kingdom is already ready to be destroyed, and it's going to be given over to who? The Medes and the Persians. United kingdom, together. They're the next kingdom. So that's one clear passage it brings about. And also, I won't have to give you all the references because you know this. Over and over again later on, chapter 6, verse 8 and 21 and over, and he says, as is written in the laws of the Medes and the Persians, that cannot be broken. Remember that saying we're going to get later on? Well, he keeps saying it's the sayings of the Medes and the Persians. Their laws cannot be broken. And what happens is it says the next kingdom is an inferior kingdom. In other words, it's not a kingdom that's ruled as authoritatively as the Babylonian Empire was, because the next empire, the Medes and Persians, have laws that usurp the power of the king. And over again, he says, I can't do it, because the laws of the Medes and Persians, once they're made, can't be broken, can't be changed. But it's the laws of the Medes and the Persians. And then in chapter 8, verse 20 and 21, you have it spelled out more clearly who some of these kingdoms are. The ram, which is one beast, thou sawest having two horns, are the kings of Medes and Persia. It's one beast, but it has two horns, the Medes and Persia. They're all one beast, one kingdom. And verse 21, and the rough goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, Alexander the Great. So already specifying these middle kingdoms that he's just touching on here, and he's going to elaborate later on in the book. So I'm saying what I think, what I've been studying, the second kingdom is a kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, and the third kingdom is the kingdom of Greece. And that's the progression that goes on. The kingdom of the Medes and Persians lasted 208 years. It lasted longer than the Babylonian Empire, but the rulers were weaker, and in many ways it was more corrupt and wicked. Then you had the third one, which was the kingdom of brass, which was Greece. It was established by Alexander the Great and lasted 185 years, almost as long as the other kingdom. The issue is not size, because every kingdom gets larger, nor necessarily the length in which the kingdom exists. What he talks about how the metals becoming inferior is each kingdom, each human kingdom that comes, is more and more corrupt, more and more debased. It's poor, a weaker kingdom in many ways, until we come to the feet, which are brass and clay. But Greece, it mentions here in the next verse, or last part of the verse, I should say, it says something very interesting about the third kingdom, which shall bear rule over all the earth. Alexander the Great extended the Grecian rule clear all the way from India up into Europe, over to Egypt. That whole vast stretch came under the power of the Greeks. And so truly, he did seem to cover all the civilized and known world. Well, that brings me to the fourth kingdom, which I think is Rome, the Roman Empire. Josephus thought that this text talked about the Roman Empire. Childs writes about the fact that all the early, the New Testament Gospels clearly understood it to be the Roman Empire, because they thought it was being fulfilled at the time of Jesus. It was the Roman Empire it was alluding to as the fourth kingdom. And he believes that all the New Testament takes it that way, the Gospels at least. And the church fathers, without exception, thought it was Rome. So we're in good company. It says this kingdom was as strong as iron. It breaks, it smashes, it breaks to pieces, it crushes, and it breaks again. He says this over and over again, stressing how Rome, when it spread, it conquered with iron. You know, iron, by the way, is the best. If you fight somebody, you know, it makes great weapons. You know, they had Iron Age that they broke to pieces all the bronze swords. And so that's the idea. Each metal gets harder, and this becomes more powerful in some ways, but the kingdom itself is filled with weaknesses. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise, and whereas thou sawest the feet and toes. Well, anyway, see this language? It's going to utterly destroy all the other kings of the earth and take control. Roman ruled with an iron hand. It shattered all who resisted her will. No one could dislodge it from power. It lasted 1,600 years, by some reckoning. The Roman Empire, in some form, it lasted a long time. Something inherently different in the second part of this we're going to look at, where it kind of changes. You have the first, the legs of iron, which I think is alluding to. Now, some people, by the way, want to get into this whole thing about, well, there's two arms and there's two legs. It's a statue of a person. Most people I see have two arms and two legs and feet and heads. It's describing a statue as it goes down, and don't make too much of those things. That's when you're trying to push the picture too far, okay? But there is something interesting about the legs. The legs start out as iron, and as we've seen, there's been big transitions in the metals that make up the statue. But then all of a sudden it goes down to the feet, And it says it's iron mixed with clay. And there's a connection between these two last parts because they have the same metal. And I think it's alluding to two different periods of this kingdom, this last kingdom. And I'll try to give you the evidence real quickly with this. It says they shall mix with men, but not cleave to one another. There shall be inner toil. These pieces are going to be linked together, but they're not going to be totally connected. There's going to be division among them. There's going to be inner turmoil in this kingdom. And that's the thing that the Roman Empire had both in its ancient form as well as in its future form, I think. Well, let me give you the evidence, I think, for this future stage to this kingdom. The change in the material and yet an inherent connection to the first part, I think, introduces two stages to this last kingdom. When the kingdom comes, the stone that's going to destroy the statue and grow into a mountain, it implies that all the earthly kingdoms, all the human kingdoms, I should say, will cease. Because it's going to totally devastate them. All kingdoms are going to collapse and be destroyed and turn to dust and shall be blown away. And it's going to annihilate them. When the heavenly kingdom comes, human kingdoms shall cease. Verse 44. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. This kingdom. When Christ came the first time, he did not bring down earthly kingdoms. He came and died around, 32 AD? And for hundreds of years, the Roman Empire continued in existence. He didn't bring down any earthly kingdom. Not at all. Rome continued for many, many years. Daniel 7 clarifies this. Nor did he establish his kingdom on earth. At that point, he says, my kingdom is not of the earth at this point in time. He talked to the disciples about a future kingdom. And they asked him when he was getting ready to ascend to heaven. He says, are you at this time going to establish your kingdom? He says, it's not for you to know when that's going to happen. You just go be my witnesses in the rest of the world. In other words, the kingdom that he was to usher in is in the future. It's not then. The mention of the toes in verse 42 mentions this 10-toe thing. There seems to be something to that. And in chapter 7, verses 23 and 24, he brings out this 10 again, but this time it's 10 horns. Then said the fourth beast, which is a parallel to, I think, this beast, or this part of the statue, shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. See, the same kind of language is used here of the fourth part of the statue. And the 10 horns out of his kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise. And they answer and shall rise after them. One of the reasons they say, well, at the time of Jesus, the Roman Empire didn't have 10 kings. I think because it's talking in the future about when the Roman Empire is revived and brought back to existence, there's going to be a federation of 10 kings, probably with European connections, that shall rebuild, in a sense, the Roman Empire as such, and shall rule over all the earth. Okay, everyone's so quiet. Let's turn to Revelation 17. Verse 12. And the 10 horns, here we have it again, which thou sawest are what? 10 kings. Now we're in the time of Revelation, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings for 1 hour with the beast. And so we have this being alluded to here, this future kingdom, the fourth kingdom that's in existence when Christ comes the first time, it shall cease to exist for a time, then shall be restored with a federation of 10 kings. And it's at that time that the Lord will come and establish his kingdom on the earth, this future stage. When we look at this statue, there's something pretty interesting about it. All the kingdoms consist of rebellious mankind defying the true God, trying to bring glory to themselves. That's why they like to build statues. And each kingdom is distinct, but they're all of one statue. They're all of one nature. All the earthly kingdoms are all part of man's rebellion against God, just like the first cities were when they built the Tower of Babel. It's man defying God and trying to be his own power and his own authority. And so all these human kingdoms are in rebellion against the true king, the true God. The progress is always downward into dishonor and disunity. The kings of the world can never bring about the utopia, the paradise that they promise when they come into power. Every king, every kingdom promises that everything's going to be better. And it gets worse because of human corruption. Man begins with a head like God and ends with disunity and problems. And it's true of each kingdom, and it's true of all the kingdoms together, because the world can never be saved by man. Well, then we have the stone. That's the heavenly kingdom, God's eternal kingdom. It will come during the revival of this fourth empire, this fourth kingdom. But the kingdom that comes with the stone is a kingdom not created by man. Its origin is in heaven itself. And God's going to bring this kingdom in existence. That's why it's a stone that's not carved or shaped by man. It's something God brought into existence. And it'll rise quickly, and it's going to obliterate the fourth kingdom. But by doing so, it's going to bring an end to all the kingdoms of man. It'll bring an end to this, to never have any more. Turn to Psalm 2. Verse 8. All right, let's start at verse 7. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said unto me, thou art my son, this day I have begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thy inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. He strikes the statue. It's blown to dust and blown away by the wind. This is talking about when the Messiah comes and establishes kingdom, and the whole world will be united against him, but he's going to bring it down and utterly destroy human kingdoms. Now understand, I'm not saying they won't cease to be nations, but they'll never be a distinct rebellious nation against God again. They'll all be under his authority, under his power, under his rule as a King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Not one of them will set themselves as the King of Kings in opposition to him. He shall rule over them all. And this will happen at his second coming. Turn to another passage, Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. And it shall come to pass in the last days that mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come ye, and let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion, out of the mountain of the Lord, shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. See, it came out of the mountain. I think Mount Zion. And it's going to utterly destroy all the other kingdoms who will come in subjection to the King of Kings and to the Lord of Lords. And God's rule shall never end. That's the future kingdom that the stone is depicting. And all the other kingdoms are of the earth, so is that kingdom. We're not talking about a spiritual kingdom that's just in the hearts of human beings. I think we're talking about a literal kingdom, because when he brings down the human kingdoms, he's going to establish his kingdom upon this earth. An earth, a kingdom on earth. I keep wanting to say earthly kingdom, but no, I wouldn't properly describe it. It's one that came out of heaven itself, but he shall rule upon this earth. We're looking forward to a kingdom on earth ruled by the Son of God, where all the nations of the world are in subjection to him. And this will come at the second coming, when there's a confederation of nations that shall rule upon the earth. But it'll be brought down, and with it all human rule. This coming will be triumphant. It'll bring an end to all other political powers. Like I said, that did not happen with his first coming. It's going to happen at his second coming, when he brings down all the earth's authorities and powers and brings them subjection to him. And its power and influence of this kingdom will spread throughout all the earth. That's hardly true with his first coming. With his first coming, yes, the gospel has gone out into all the earth. But I think pretty much, you may disagree with me, but I think pretty much all the nations of the world are in rebellion against God. That's kind of a strong statement. Would anyone here disagree with that? I know one time people would say, no, the United States. I don't think we can say that anymore. All the nations of the world are in rebellion against God. The gospel's gone out into all the world for the most part. We're not turning the world around. No, that will happen when Jesus Christ comes back and establishes kingdom upon the earth and brings down all the rebellious kingdoms of the world and brings them in subjection. And this will happen. Revelation talks about that. And then things will be set right. And that's why we pray the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We look forward to that coming kingdom. We long for it, or at least we should. And we believe that someday Jesus is coming back, and he will set things right. Well, after giving this interpretation, look how the king responds. Go back to our text. In fact, I should read up to that. And whereas thou sawest the 10 feet and toes, part of the potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. This future kingdom, this future revival of the Roman Empire will be divided. But there shall be in it some of strength, some strong nations, some kings, and some weaker ones. For as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with the clay. And as the toes and the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. Or bitter, brittle, I should say. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to one another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. In other words, this is going to be a loosely knit confederation. They're not going to totally get along. Can you imagine all the nations of Europe getting along? Our friend from Scotland smiled. They can't even get the island to get along. You know, it's divided and always will be to the end. Well, he gave this interpretation. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom, so in the days of these kings, these last kings, shall the God of heaven set up his kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So when this happens, that last kingdom is going to be brought down, and God's going to establish his kingdom forever. For as much as thou sawest the stone was cut off of the mountain without hands, and that break in pieces the iron and the brass, the clay and the silver and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof is sure. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel, and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. He says, wow, this is something. We need to pay homage and respect to Daniel. But don't get us wrong. He's not totally worshiping Daniel as a god. That's why he doesn't respond, because look what he says. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth, it is your God. He is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealer of secrets. Seeing now, could this reveal his secret? I respect you as his messenger, but it's this God that I recognize. Now, don't think that he became a believer at that point. I don't think he did. They're polytheists. They just add one more God. He just thinks this is probably the best God right now, because look what he can do and none of the others could. Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon. So David is exalted to the highest position in the kingdom over the area of the key city Babylon as chief, and the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. So now he's moved to the not just top of his class, he's the top of all the wise men in Babylon. And then Dan requested of the king that he should set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in this capital city and stayed there, and they kind of went out and did his bidding on out. God raised him up. The key thing about this lesson that I want you to catch is what it reveals about our God. That's the whole point of the dream. You may differ on the fine details of it. People do. But the point is, God is sovereign over the earth. Everything that's occurring is under his sovereign control. The greatest of all kings, Nebuchadnezzar, is there because God has placed him there, and God's going to allow a few other kingdoms to come into power after him. And there's going to be a last kingdom that's going to be established. There'll be, I think, a revival of the fourth kingdom. But when that happens, God's going to bring down all human kingdoms and establish his kingdom over the whole earth. And he shall reign supreme, because God is sovereign over the future. Also, God is omniscient. There's nothing he doesn't know. He knows the king's dreams. He knows all the details of what's going to happen. He knows exactly what the future holds for us. And he knows how it's all going to come out in the end. There's nothing our God does not know. Well, if we have an all-powerful God, and we have a God of such great wisdom and knowledge, even when we're under the control of a foreign power like Babylon, and even though Daniel and his friends have been carried off into captivity and seem like slaves, have lost control of their lives, nothing is out of control. And when they trust themselves to this God can lift them and exalt them in this pagan capital to the highest positions and places of power. Because God is God. And he can do what he wants to do with his people and with the kingdoms of the world. They think they're in control. They are not. Our God is in control. And so we can trust him with our future. Empires will rise and empires will fall, and eventually God's kingdom will come and establish his authority on the earth, and all these kingdoms will be annihilated as rebellious entities. The kingdom is coming, which we long for, which we pray for. And when it does, all this will end, and Christ shall reign supreme forever. That's our hope, and it's certain. Amen.